Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we look inside the secret world of spying and intelligence agencies. Then, we'll explore the fast-changing world of journalism and media and what it means for governance and democracy. The inner workings of intelligence gathering agencies has long been a sort of black box to the American public. How many are there? How do they cooperate and function? How have they changed? And what reforms are needed? Glenn Carl served 23 years in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, working four continents and in Washington, D.C. His last position was as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats on the National Intelligence Council, where he was responsible for strategic analysis of terrorism, international organized crime, and narcotics. His book, The Interrogator, explores doubt that he faced with his most serious assignment, where he interrogated who was thought to be one of the most senior al-Qaeda detainees. You were with the agency 23 years. Maybe a good place to start would be how you experienced the agency change over those 23 years.
Oh, dramatically. Not too long after I retired in 2007, I was on a panel. And the first question, it was a woman, a junior officer, and she said, "Mr. Carl, what was the single biggest change you noticed in the CIA from the beginning to the end of your career?" No question in my mind, and that is the changed role of women. When I started in the mid-80s, early mid-80s, in the Directorate of Operations, there were a few, very few, senior females, and they had to be really, really tough because they would have been steamrolled. There were junior officer females, peers of mine at that time, just starting. And otherwise, to put it somewhat crudely, but not too inaccurately, women were viewed as support staff or there for the pleasure of the men who did the real work.
What else did you see change? Did it grow? Did it shrink? Did the focus move?
Oh, many times the focus changed. I mean, of course, the agency will reflect broader changes in the society. So also, when I first started, if one were homosexual, one would be fired or prosecuted. And then midpoint in my career, the laws changed and the regulations, I think because of President Clinton. And now to be gay is irrelevant and routine. So the agency's changed sociologically that way too. There are types of intelligence work that become the in thing and they rise and fall over time. So the paramilitary work of the CIA was very important when I first began in the mid-80s, and that's because of two things largely: the efforts to defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan and the war with the Sandinistas and the Contras. And so those were in subjects, and there was a huge focus then on paramilitary Special Activities Division work. When the Cold War and those wars ended or petered out, then the paramilitary activities were no longer in vogue, and the resources were redirected towards the traditional work of the agency again, which is human intelligence collection.
When you say human, you mean on particular individuals?
Convincing individuals to spy for the United States. So I would approach an individual and say, "Have I got a deal for you?" That's the heart and soul of the CIA's job. Special activities, paramilitary work, those are sexy things.
And the paramilitary work, you mean recruiting the paramilitaries to work on behalf of?
No, not necessarily. People who are highly trained, very impressive professionals in military skills. So if we are supporting the Mujahideen in their war against Afghanistan, the fact that I studied Thucydides in French is not directly relevant to the task. But if you're a special operations veteran, your skills are directly relevant to helping our allies in their effort against the Soviets. So that's paramilitary work. There are other things too. When the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended, then the central mission historically of the CIA ended, which was the Soviets. And we had to redirect again. And for a time, there was a debate, a search for, well, what is our raison d'etre? What's the mission now? And so is it economic intelligence? Is it political intelligence? What? George Tenet in the mid-90s, I think, saved the Directorate of Operations by reinvigorating and focusing resources once again on human intelligence collection. 6 years later, in 2001, of course, 9/11 occurred, and once again, paramilitary work as relevant to counterterrorism operations became the prime focus of where people wanted to go, because you always want to be the pointy end of the spear.
How did changes in the administration affect the CIA?
it's tremendously influential.
Give us some examples. You were there 23 sure. years. That's a long time.
Well, yes, unfortunately. Or fortunately. When I started my career, Bill Casey was the director, and he was a veteran of the OSS in World War II. So for him, bureaucracy and the rules were hindrances and irritations, and he found the agency culture to get in his way.
Because the agency
followed the rules and had procedures, and part of the rules are to obey the laws. And he was mission-oriented, one could say, and he wanted to get the Sandinistas, and don't be a hidebound bureaucrat for me when I'm telling you that that's the mission. Arguably, that attitude led to Iran-Contra. When the directors changed, so did the culture. John Deutsch was focused on technical intelligence. He thought that satellites were important. And of course, everyone, these are all shades of degree, but he also thought that human intelligence was slow, outdated, and done very poorly by the CIA. So he was open in his denigration of the Directorate of Operations and Human Intelligence Collection, which was the historic core of CIA's mission and heart of its culture. So he was not highly regarded by many of his subordinates. And then it changed again. So the director is critical, very influential in our attitudes, as is presidential administration.
Because the presidential administration would appoint the director.
In part because of that, but also because of the administration's focus and the issues to which it will have to respond. So George Bush II was obviously seized with 9/11 and counterterrorism, and that became the central activity of the Central Intelligence Agency and the administration for the 8 years of the Bush administration. The administration would argue that that was a response to necessity. One could argue otherwise, that it was a choice. But whatever the answer to that issue, the fact is that the agency follows the guidance and does the bidding of the executive, and the executive wanted counterterrorism as a priority, and so that's what it was.
In terms of the other intelligence agencies, is there a relationship, and how does it work, if so?
To answer that would be the work of multiple books. The relations are intimate, ongoing, 25 hours a day, all the time, among all the now 17 agencies of the intelligence community.
17,
right.
Can you name some of them?
Oh, sure. Well, there's the CIA, everyone knows about. There's the National Security Agency, which does electronic intelligence, picking up radio conversations and so on. There's the National Geospatial Agency that does satellite observation. There is the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the Department of State that does analysis. There's the Defense Intelligence Agency that is a military copy of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was explicitly created by Robert McNamara so that the Secretary of Defense would not have to be beholden to an agency not under his control, and that has continued. One could argue that there is a lot of redundancy, but the counterargument is that different opinions working on the same issue provide perspectives that are complementary. Then there's Marine Corps Intelligence Agency and the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and so on. The core intelligence agencies are CIA, DIA, NSA, INR, Defense Intelligence Agency, State Department Intelligence and Research. So they're huge, and they work together in an infinite number of ways all the time. They do operations together overseas. They do analysis together or as constructive rivals on any issue.
Then say the CIA was working on an issue, say, in Afghanistan. You also have Army intelligence there. Do you have FBI there also?
The FBI is overseas in many countries, so it's quite possible they would be there, yes. Let me give a concrete example. Let's say the president wants to know what's happening in Waziristan, the ungoverned border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The question would go to the National Intelligence Council, where I was the deputy national intelligence officer for terrorism, essentially. And I would call together to chair a meeting of the intelligence community. Each of the 17 agencies would send a representative, and I would say, the president has asked us to assess what's going on in Waziristan. And I would then dole out or coordinate how the responses would be prepared. I'd say, I need your respective assessments in 3 days. And they would send them to me, and then we would hash out. I would put it together in some sort of a coherent structure, and then we would hash it out. And I would say, okay, NSA says there's nothing happening, and CIA says that they have 400 nuclear weapons there. What's the truth? How do we answer? What do we do? And you hash it out. So you work together analytically all the time. Also, my experiences are typical. That's why the examples are useful. I was an operations officer for most of my career, meaning that I conducted operations to penetrate terrorist organizations overseas. And I worked intimately with the FBI on any number of cases, and I worked with the military on cases, and they brought their operational perspectives and expertise, as I did as a CIA officer, together to say, well, you know, I can pick the lock here, or I know how to speak that language, and we'll do this thing together.
You mentioned earlier about the Iran-Contra scandal, and there were quite a few convictions in that. And you've also described in your book this sort of gray, having to choose between unethical and unethical, essentially, or borderline ethical. And I wonder, when you look at Iran-Contra, can you put that into a context of the kind of gray area that you found yourself working in?
Oh, I can directly and firsthand, because it is a precursor experientially for me and should have been for the agency and our government of what I lived in the global war on terror. The gray area, well, I'll give an example. One of my superiors when I was working on Iran, I never worked in Iran, on Contra Sandinista issues, was sent to Central America. And the Boland Amendment had made it illegal for the United States, therefore the CIA, to provide lethal aid to the Contras. Well, that's the law. His job was to work with the Contras in circumstances in which the men with whom he worked were going off into combat routinely. And he was forbidden to arm them, but his orders were to have them conduct these missions. So that was a dilemma for him, because he didn't really want to send people unarmed, most likely to their deaths. And he had to decide what to do. And what he chose to do, unbeknownst to anyone else, was he provided them lethal aid. And that came out, and he was charged. And as I recall in testimony, the senator asked him, sir, are you aware of the Boland Amendment that outlawed that? And he said, yes, sir, I am. Did you provide lethal aid, sir? And he said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, how can you explain having knowingly broken the law, given your oath? And he said, sir, I don't know what things are like where you come from, but where I come from, you don't send people off to their deaths without giving them at least a chance to defend themselves. And I think one can only sympathize with the dilemma that he confronted, and he chose a path that was illegal. But he was in a terrible dilemma, and arguably you could say it was a clear issue that he can't break the law, but I think it was a gray moral crisis where no choice was the right one for him.
How often is that before you or your colleagues?
Something as stark as that, a life and death situation of war and clear legal obligations that one breaks, is rare. And that's an extreme example. I knew that man well. He's a fine man. More typical is a morally gray issue where your job is to get someone to commit treason. And to do that, you have to play upon that individual's deepest hopes and win his deepest trust, or hers, and then use that trust to serve the ends of the United States, which are not necessarily good for the individual, but that is the job. So there is a constant tension between the need to manipulate to accomplish your mission and your effort, which will be sincere also, to be of good faith to the man whose trust you are winning.
You said that you had to break laws, steal, lie about almost everything, and exploit people to
that
do your job.
That's the job. I was going to say a paradox, but it is an exceptional challenge, morally, intellectually, and psychologically, to win someone's trust sincerely. And to do the job right, you really have to. People see through falsity more often than one would imagine. So you do want to be a good friend to this person, the angel of his hopes. And
that had to create cognitive dissonance.
For many, I think it does, and many officers, well, few people suited psychologically to do the job, and the agency does a good job of sifting, and then people early in their career will sift themselves, because it is a strange series of paradoxes that one lives all the time. Those who can work out how to compartment your simultaneously shared but contradictory emotions and moral obligations become good officers, and those who don't will leave. But dissonance, I don't know if I felt cognitive dissonance. I became good and at ease psychologically with my job, but it took a while to learn, because also paradoxically, but sensibly, the agency seeks to hire people of high moral rectitude who are deeply principled. And that is a contradiction with the obligation to manipulate others' deepest principles in a Machiavellian way, but that's the job.
So how many officers are there at a time in the CIA operating like this?
Well, that I can't say. That's a classified number. But I think I can say the general public will imagine that the CIA is everywhere. And certainly foreigners imagine that every time a traffic light goes out in La Paz, Bolivia, that it's the dark hand of the CIA is behind it. And we would always joke and think, well, if only. In fact, the CIA is shockingly small, or the Directorate of Operations, shockingly small. People, I don't think, would believe how few of us there are. And it's typically our errors are those events that are discussed. But I think the agency and its personnel do, on the whole, remarkable work, given the resources that are spread really pretty thin.
There's a section in your book where you're describing what you went through, particularly with regards to this person who was the suspected high-level al-Qaeda person. And you said some call it torture, but you didn't yourself call it torture in the book.
Did I not? Maybe I didn't
use those words. Do you consider it torture?
The simple answer is yes. Certainly the Bush administration and the agency worked hard to muddy the waters on that. And it is true that no one in the agency acted without direct authorization. I'm confident of that. And the authorization came from the president. And we were told that the president had consulted with the Department of Justice to verify that all actions that were ordered and authorized were legal. And the agency was explicit, people above me, the senior levels of the agency, that it received clear legal guidance and authorization before doing anything. All of that is true. It's also true, however, that the guidance received was a hackwork bit of political flimflammery written by a political appointee that had nothing to do with 800 years of Western history and 250 years of American history that didn't even make a mockery. It simply destroyed a habeas corpus, trial by jury, rules of evidence, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the Convention Against Torture, the Geneva Conventions, the Executive Order 12333, which guides CIA officers' operations, and it was clearly in contradiction with them all. So was it legal or illegal? One can argue, if one is a casuist, that it is both. You know, morally, the spirit of our laws and the clear laws and regulations we had, the actions that we engaged in are at the very least unacceptable.
It seems to me that you wrote this book partly because of that experience seeming wrong to you and the administration's particular directive.
Oh, you don't need any qualifiers whatsoever. I wrote the book because I was terribly distressed, shocked, but sincerely shocked. I'm not the Casablanca pretense here, and deeply, deeply concerned as an American citizen, that I was one of the few people who has firsthand knowledge and experience in what we did to ourselves and how gravely and egregiously we undermined and contravened the principles, regulations, practices, spirit, and letter of our laws and our society. And if I didn't write about this, I would then be a tacit cover-upper, and I wouldn't do it. That this, to me, what we did and what we have done to ourselves is as grave a crisis with as deep an impact on American laws, institutions, and society as anything that the United States has done since the internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans because their eyes slant only, that's the only reason, or since My Lai, or since McCarthyism.
Do you think most of your colleagues are on the same page as you?
I think most of my colleagues were profoundly disturbed about the impossible choices and dilemmas in which the CIA and its officers were placed. And there is always a bell curve of response to any specific action or circumstance. But generally, overall, the bell curve, all but maybe one or two standard deviations on the extreme, shared deep concern about what we were doing and what we did to ourselves. And our job is to do the hard tasks that are unclear as to whether they work or are right, but are ordered and we are assured are legal and in the national interests.
So in the 23 years you were with the agency, was this the first time that you felt this level of disturbance?
Oh, certainly. As I said, I worked on the Contra Sandinista war. I worked on the kidnapping of American officials, the CIA chief, and American civilians in Lebanon. I did counterterrorism work. I recruited people to commit treason. That was my day-to-day job for 23 years. There was nothing remotely as disturbing or that has raised as grave issues about American society and our government as the enhanced interrogation program and the misperceptions and delusions of the war on terror. Nothing remotely like it.
And where does the line get crossed? How does it get from this is okay to this is awful?
The agency and its officers take our oaths really very, very seriously, to the point of sacrificing or devoting our lives to it. And the oath is to preserve and protect the Constitution of the United States, uphold its laws, and serve the national interest. And the national interest can be ruthless, but it can never be to traduce the values and the laws that we are sworn to protect and the interests we are sworn to advance. And so when you have clear laws, the Convention Against Torture, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you have all the checks and balances of our General Counsel's office in every sub-bureau of the agency and the government and the Department of Justice and the General Counsel's office and the director of the CIA's office and in the White House, and you have oversight committees and on, and you have all of these measures to guide and make sure that our practices and actions are acceptable and serve the national interest, and all of them fail because of the work of or the actions of about a half dozen people, so that our laws no longer protect us, and our regulations and oversight practices no longer protect us, and our officers take actions that undermine the Constitution and habeas corpus and don't protect us. This is terrifying, because our government is then no longer a government of laws. And to say it sounds crazy, that doesn't happen in America, but it did. I lived it. And that is very frightening. And then even worse is that not only did it happen, but it happened with the broad, although innocent and ignorant, support of the American people, who had been told, we are protecting you, we are doing things that are necessary, it's okay. And the people said, well, okay, that's right. And that's right then accepted practices that undermined our laws. And that is really shocking.
You retired before President Obama took office, but I imagine you still have a sense of if things have changed back.
Well, I know that they changed quite a bit back. I know John Brennan well, and I think very highly of him. He has a quite sophisticated view of the nature of the terrorist threat and a sophisticated and deep understanding of and commitment to our laws in spirit and practice and letter. And I know for a fact the paradigm that shapes our sense of the nature of the terrorist threat and the actions that we can take to counter it is radically different now than it was under the previous administration.
Two last questions. One is, now with your background and understanding through all these administrations and all of the questioning that you've done internally, what is your sense of Guantanamo Bay and what should be done about that?
Guantanamo is a blight on our society. Candidate Obama was right to say that that was the case and that he would close it. It is more than lamentable that because of political pressure and some practical considerations, to be fair, but for political pressure, he's been unable to close it.
Political pressure being what?
Well, the Republicans have come up with any number of arguments saying that we can't bring detainees onto American soil. It's too dangerous. I just find that would be laughable were it not so outrageous.
What about the agency itself? What is it saying?
Well, most parts of the national security establishment, most agencies, have wished to and sought to close Guantanamo, I would say, for years and years and years. The practical problems to which I alluded, however, are there are some detainees who will be tortured if they are returned to their countries of origin. By law and morally, we cannot do that. And the Bush administration struggled with this problem too, and so it wouldn't send them back. Cannot. The administrations have been unable to bring these people to American soil for trial. So what do you do with them if Republicans make it impossible to bring them to the soil for detention or trial? We can't try some of them because the evidence that would be used was obtained either by measures that are arguably illegal or obtained through intelligence sources and methods, which, if revealed, would endanger the lives of our sources and our practices. So we're stuck, and no one has been able to figure out what to do. But it is a blight, because habeas corpus, I would argue, if one had to choose one practice in Western civilization that is the triumph and foundation of our freedoms, it is habeas corpus, and it is not just made a mockery, it does not exist.
Last thing I want to close with your experience, especially your last few years, if you were going to propose reforms to particularly the CIA, but also into the intelligence world, maybe they're political because of what you were facing from the top levels, what would you propose?
Well, this is one of the distressing points and conclusions that I come to, and I'm afraid I dismay, if not dishearten, people that ask me this issue when it comes up, because the terrifying, frankly terrifying, reality discovery that I made, among many, as I was involved in the war on terror and specifically interrogating this individual about whom I write, is that the laws are in place. We have many laws against torture and how to follow certain procedures to obey the laws as officials in the executive branch. Oversight does exist. Legal staffs know their obligations. Officers take an oath and know our obligations. We don't need more laws. We don't need more regulation. None of it sufficed to stop a half dozen or 10 dedicated, purposeful men from overthrowing all the efforts of thousands of good people over hundreds of years. It didn't suffice. It was very easy. So laws don't answer the problem. And I think the only thing one can do is to bear witness and shed light. And light and knowledge of practices make it harder to do wrong. I think that's the only thing that we didn't do that we could do, because all the other measures had been put in place and were there to protect us, and they failed.
You were clearly disturbed about this. Did you and your colleagues discuss it amongst yourselves, and did you have a sense that others were equally disturbed?
Oh, I knew that many were disturbed, but I will say during the time I was involved in the interrogation of this individual and was running it or part of it, the work pace is so intense that one doesn't have sessions in which one mulls over issues like this. And also, you receive your orders, and you have to try to do them as best as you can. And you don't argue with your subordinates, gee, you know, I think there's a morally ambiguous position here. And you don't say to your superiors that, really, although you are encouraged and expected to bring your judgment to issues at all times, nonetheless, you have to get on with the job. So there wasn't a lot of hand-wringing discussion during that phase. At headquarters, for years, however, many of us openly discussed the contradictions of our orders from our obligations and what to do about it. And it was, frankly, a frightening time, because to challenge authority led to professional and personal destruction. That's Orwellian.
Our guest is Glenn Carle, and the book he has written is The Interrogator, An Education. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
What rapid changes in mass media mean? Up next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The so-called Fourth Estate has been rapidly changing, both in style and in substance. Among the developments, a number of newspapers have been shutting their doors and facing bankruptcy and leaving a void in some important civic information. What do these changes mean for their audiences and for democratic governance? Three experts on mass media and communication join us now. James T. Hamilton is a professor of public policy, economics, and political science, and the director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy. He's the author of All the News That's Fit to Sell, How the Market Transforms Information into News, and Channeling Violence, the Economic Market for Violent Television Programming. Ben Compain is director of the Fellows Program at Columbia University Institute for Teleinformation and lecturer at the Damore McKim School of Business at Northeastern University. He's the author of The Digital Divide, Who Owns the Media, and The Internet Upheaval. Victor Picard is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is co-editor of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? And was a lead author for Saving the News Toward a National Journalism Strategy. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. The Pew Center has reported that resources are dwindling. News media is increasingly unable to uncover stories or dig deep into emerging ones. What are the trends that we're seeing in addition to this? And what does all of this really mean for citizens, audiences, and for U.S. politics? Jay Hamilton?
The price of newspapers has gone down radically in the last 10 years. It's easier, it's cheaper to buy newspaper companies. If you look back, say, to the 1980s, there were two industries in the U.S. where family or individual ownership was predominant: media companies and sports franchises. And in both of those industries, people got a sort of psychic income for playing a role in their community. And with the price of newspapers going down, in part because of the revenues going down, if you wanted to buy a newspaper in part to impart your worldviews to others, the price of that is going down.
Victor Picard, let's bring you in. Would you agree with that assessment? And what else do you see?
I 100% agree with Jay's analysis here. And just to give another concrete example of similar phenomenon with the devaluation of newspapers here in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia newspapers sold for $55 million a year ago. They went for $460 million more dollars back in 2006. So that's a radical devaluation. They're definitely becoming much more affordable for especially wealthy individuals like the Koch brothers to purchase. But to just back up a little bit, I think to ask why newspapers are becoming so devalued, it really traces back to a fundamental flaw with their business model, namely their reliance on advertising revenue. As readers and advertisers migrate to the internet, where digital ads pay pennies to the dollar of traditional paper-based advertising, their advertising revenue is plummeting, which is leading to fewer and fewer news-related jobs. You had mentioned the Pew Research Center earlier. They found that there's about 30% declines in the reporting and editing capacity at American newspapers since 2000. So I think that's one of the larger issues that we should discuss in terms of the implications of what's happening with this gradual collapse of the newspaper industry.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want to get into. And maybe something that will preface that is really how much does ownership matter on content? Ben Compain, that's something that you look at. What do you think?
That's a good point, because there's always this perception that owners, especially the old family owners, the Sulzbergers and the McCormicks of old, as I think Jay said, enjoyed the influence or the perceived influence. And yet, study after study has shown very little influence of newspapers. There's the editorial page, which most people never read in the first place, and the impact of editorials has always been, in research terms, sort of iffy. Most newspapers have avoided having opinions, at least very, very blatant, on their news pages, and when they have, it's at their own peril. In my last book, or last research, I looked at 17 studies that concluded that there are very few differences in editorials, whether or not it's owned by groups or by individuals. A major research study that came out a couple of years ago from a couple of economists at the University of Chicago found that owners had far less impact on what the editorial slant of the newspaper was than the consumers in the areas in which they published. That is, they found in general terms that newspapers in what we call red states tended to be slightly more conservative than newspapers in blue states, regardless of their owners, even if the same owners. and that is the newspaper tends to slightly reflect the interests of the consumers rather than the other way around.
That's a chicken and egg question, and I think that's something Jay Hamilton has also looked at. You've looked at it from the perspective of what people want versus what they need being provided in newspapers. What would you say to this?
I would agree with Ben that audience interest is one of the paramount drivers in newspaper content on the news pages. But if you think about that Chicago study, what they showed was that if you're in a state where people use the word death tax rather than inheritance tax, death tax is going to be more likely to be used in the newspaper. Whereas if you're in a state where politicians talk about the inheritance tax is the word that's going to be used. Objectivity has been a commercial product and came about in the U.S. press around the 1870s when you had the invention of very expensive high-speed presses. And in order to spread the cost of that press around, people stopped being the Democratic or the Republican paper. They became the independent paper because they could get a lot more readers and sell those people to advertisers. What the decline in the advertising value of a newspaper means is that for somebody like the Koch brothers, if they did decide that they wanted to have a more slanted paper that went against audience demand, the cost to them would be lower because there's less revenue from advertising coming in now.
Victor, let's go to the point that you bring up that there may be a consequence to this. What do you think that is?
Aside from these questions about ideology and bias in journalistic coverage, we also should look at just the role of newspapers, which are really the last bastion of actual journalism.
What about radio?
I'm sorry. Of course, radio, there's some fantastic radio journalism still going on. But increasingly, newspapers are providing a lot of kind of raw materials for the rest of the media ecosystem. And there was a study, again, by the Pew Research Center in Baltimore in 2009. The report came out in 2010 that looked at a week of media coverage in Baltimore. They were looking at everything, both old and new media, including newspapers, radio, television, blogs, even Twitter dispatches. And they found that despite what seemed like this proliferation of media, most of the news that people received did not contain original reporting. They found that old media, like, for example, the Baltimore Sun, was still generating more than 95% of original news stories. So this gives you a sense of the importance, the centrality of even these suffering newspapers for the larger ecosystem. Because the same study found that the Baltimore Sun was at a fraction of its capacity of where it had been 10 or 20 years ago. So I think this raises a number of concerns.
Ben Compain.
All this is true. The problem is there's not much we can do about it. We can talk about and wring our hands at the declining revenue of newspapers and therefore fewer resources. And I think that's right, that much of what we see in other media is still being originated with newspapers. And we haven't yet developed a model to replace that. And I think we're still in the early stages. Something's going to have to develop. One of my concerns is this notion of be careful what you wish for, because for decades we were wishing for greater diversity and ownership, more media sources. We only had three TV networks, and most cities had one or two newspapers. And now we have this huge division of our attention, for good or bad, but that means that no one source, including broadcasters, television broadcasters, is dominant and therefore has the resources that they had in the past. And we haven't put together a new model to replace that.
Well, that brings up another point, which is this potential balkanization of audiences or polarization of audiences who only go to one set of sources and never hear the other side. If they're just Fox News listeners or just MSNBC listeners, what does that do to our electorate?
This is Ben. That's sort of what I was just trying to get to. And you're right that I think both our personal experience as well as the research says that Fox News is watched primarily by people who agree and like what they hear on Fox News and MSNBC. And we've always had that. People who bought the New Republic or the National Review had that frame of reference, but they were also watching the CBS Evening News or reading their local newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer or whatever. And today, that's not happening as much, and I think we're getting more and more stovepiped.
Well, Jay Hamilton, let's go back to you for a moment here, because you've done a lot about how the market really affects the media content. And one of the things you looked at was violence, for example, and we saw the Boston bomber being covered in a particular way across it, seemingly most media. Can you give us a sense of why we're seeing this?
I actually think that there are a couple of, believe it or not, public policy levers that we could use, even though I'm a very strong believer in the First Amendment. The things that we've been talking about often been problems of demand. Are people strongly interested enough in public affairs stories so that they would be covered? But there are a couple of things that the government could do right now to make it more likely that stories about government accountability journalism would be told. And one of them deals with IRS and tax policy. If you look over the last couple of years, you've seen local outlets which are nonpartisan that are trying to form and cover what could be called broccoli journalism, stories about schools and the environment and community development. You have MinnPost, Voice of San Diego, St. Louis Beacon. And what the IRS has started to do is slow down the approval of those nonprofit local public affairs websites. So while it's good to focus on what the market is giving you, there are a set of people who are saying, you know what, the market is not going to tell the local accountability journalism stories in my area. I'd like to form something that would tell it. And so far, the government has made that harder rather than easier.
So local accountability stories would be one aspect that's missing from media, perhaps because of market forces, if we look at your model. I'm guessing there are a lot of other things that are missing. Victor Picard.
Yeah, we know that there are quite a few gaps that are emerging in news coverage. Local stories, also international stories, especially as foreign bureaus are dismantled due to cost-cutting measures. You also see stories at the state level covering state governments are going increasingly unreported. I agree with Jay that there are a number of things that the government could do to try to correct for what could be seen as a kind of market failure to support the public service mission of journalism. In addition to tweaking tax laws to help new startups, the government could also make it easier for existing news organizations to transition into nonprofit or low profit status. And also the question of subsidies needs to come up. It's often a very delicate subject within American political discourse, not nearly so in other democracies. We should start thinking about in various creative ways to provide public subsidies for, in my preference, it would be for nonprofit journalistic ventures. It's something that we should at least have on the table.
The San Diego Tribune is kind of an example where a conservative owner came in and started to move its ideology more and more towards his bent, and people had nowhere else to go. How much would it change the overall media ecosystem, to use Victor's word, if we had somebody like the Koch brothers or the Murdochs really take these, say, something like the Tribune or more newspapers? Would it start to change the ideology more? Ben Compain.
Of course, it's a factor. There's no ideological litmus test for purchasing or starting or running any media organization. The only thing you can look at is whether or not there's any monopoly or tendency to monopolize concentration. So to that extent, there's almost nothing you can do about it. Personally, I'm not very concerned about this because there are lots of places to go. Most newspapers have been losing circulation as it is. My guess is if some radical left or right wing, whatever ideologue, bought a major newspaper and permeated the whole paper with it, that would just accelerate the decline, except for the small hardcore that may like that. I think Jay said that the cost of doing that is much less than a few years ago, but also the result of that would be much less because, again, you'd be talking to the choir. If someone wants to try that, let them try that. It probably will cost them a lot of money, and they'll probably have minimal influence. And it also perhaps leaves a hole for someone else to come along and say, look, you know, San Diego or whoever doesn't have a mainstream newspaper. We can start one for 3 days a week or something, and also at low cost. So there are different ways that could go.
I'd also like to look at the internet now and how that and social media are changing this entire media landscape. Jay Hamilton, you've talked a bit about this in your work. How do you see the effects?
One thing that the internet and social media has done in some sense is that it has lowered the cost of discovering some stories. Investigative reporters are starting to use Twitter as a way to follow some leads. And if you think about the prospects of what journalism could do if they had better tools and algorithms, right now journalists are outmatched when they try to cover the government. The government has a lot of great software that watches us, and we have very imperfect tools to watch them, or even campaigns. If you think about the social media targeting and the targeting in email that the Obama campaign used. In the old days, newspapers and campaigns both used pollsters, so it was sort of equal when they were studying public opinion. And ProPublica has tried to use text mining of emails to discover what campaigns are doing. But I think one thing that could be done is, it's a clunky term called computational journalism, but if you could basically combine transparency and open government with better use of data and algorithms, you could lower the cost of telling accountability journalism stories.
Victor Picard.
I agree that the internet has created new potentials for disseminating news. And there have been some studies that actually show that more people are reading traditional print news, although online oftentimes, than ever before. But I think that the problem here is that we really haven't figured out a way to monetize news online in a way that could sustain jobs, that could sustain journalistic production to the capacity that our society requires. So I'm still not entirely optimistic about the future of digital journalism. There have been numerous measures. Probably the most well-known is what's known as the paywall, an online subscription model. And the New York Times and many news organizations are experimenting with various forms of this, which some have likened to a Hail Mary pass for the newspaper industry. But I'm actually in the middle of a study right now that's looking at the performance of paywalls. It's not concluded yet, but right now it seems that while they are generating some revenue and they're kind of able to tread water for a while, they're not making up for previous losses. And it's hard to see how this will be a sustainable model for the long term.
The internet has a positive and a negative aspect. One is when people do see something that they're interested in, they might dig a little bit deeper and they might find those sources. But the other is, it seems to me, there is a low cost to spreading false information.
Yep, this is Ben. I tend to be a glass half full type of guy. I think in the history of literacy, from oral literacy to written literacy, conventions had to be developed over time to create trust. I won't go into it now, but things like indentures and red tape actually were techniques that helped give credibility to written documents at a time when oral records were still predominant. And I think we're early in this period of trying to find ways of authenticating and becoming, you might say, literate in the digital world. And we've only been at this for a decade or two, and I suspect we'll get there. In the meantime, there might be some problems.
Jay Hamilton, you've looked at this also. Is there a danger in the internet with this ability of anybody to post something and it being false?
It is the case that on the internet, it's very cheap to have a website. There are low cost to entry. And as Ben was saying, in the old days, one reason you might be accurate is that you had something at risk. It might have been the investment that you had in your printing press or the reputation that you had. And so on the online world, you're going to have people with much less at risk, and it might lead them to be more inaccurate. In our discussion today, we've sort of talked about news in terms of being slanted or being inaccurate. And when I think of how news markets are changing, to me, a fundamental problem is stories that aren't told at all, in part because they're so costly. So I live in a town where the number of people in the newsroom has gone from 250 to 90 over the last 6 years. And there are whole parts of our metro area, both geographically and substantively, that no longer have beat reporters. So to me, the biggest market failure in the U.S. is that if you look at newspaper markets in the local area, there are simply things that they can't afford to cover, can't afford to have the expertise anymore. The New York Times is doing well because they can aggregate up the advertising and subscription of college-educated people around the U.S., but there is no New York Times of a place like Raleigh, North Carolina.
And then there's also the issue of not being able to cover international matters with any kind of a depth for a very similar reason, a financial reason.
That's right.
Victor Picard.
I agree. I think we were talking about this earlier about these, some people refer to as news deserts that are emerging in our media landscape. And again, I think we need to consider various forms of funding news, structural alternatives for funding news. And I mentioned subsidies, but just to give a couple more specific examples, one idea that's been proposed is that we repurpose some of the money that's currently used for funding international broadcasting, like Voice of America. There's $670 million that the U.S. puts toward international broadcasting every year. Just a fraction of that put towards kind of public media system, whether we want to repurpose our public broadcast system to maybe bring it more in line with the funding levels that other democracies devote towards their public media. That would be a huge step. There's another proposal out there that suggests that individuals could be given tax vouchers to put towards their choice of media. So there are ways to fund, to subsidize media that don't involve direct subsidies from the government that I think we should consider.
Well, let me just explore a couple of other models that I saw in other countries, that I saw in Mexico and in France. There were a couple of journalism co-ops where journalists actually owned it together. I believe it was essentially nonprofit, so there wasn't the drive to have endless profits and make money for their shareholders so much. So they had to raise less money, just enough for the operation and to support themselves. Would something like that work in the U.S.? And I know it was tried in Chicago and didn't work. That might have been for other reasons. Jay Hamilton.
The Chicago News Co-op was interesting. That was one example where they had applied to the IRS for nonprofit status and had not received it by the time they went and ceased operation. I think that there are ways to try to encourage people to work for things other than profit maximization. So you do have some people who are willing to work for less than they would earn in the market. A lot of them try to work for these nonprofit news sites. Essentially, in the 80s and before, we were relying on one or two families in an area to not maximize profits, to tell stories that might not be the most profitable stories, but were important to the community. And with changes in the tax laws in the 1980s, you have the corporatization of newspapers where the responsibility now is to maximize returns to shareholders. But I do think across the country, you are seeing some experiments where people are saying, let's try to get together. And in some cities, it might be 10 or 12 people with a $1 million budget funded through philanthropy to try to tell the education or environment or growth stories that aren't being told by the local media.
We've been talking about news a lot, and I know news itself has a little bit of a bias. You know, it's got to be current. It's got to be not dog bites man, but man bites dog. That's sort of the unusual aspect of what's happening. It tends to be dramatic and event-oriented. But isn't there other information that is really important that perhaps should be covered, and does it have a chance? Ben Compain.
I forget who just mentioned that, but the stories that don't get told and the in-depth reporting in Philadelphia, Bartlett and Steele at the Inquirer used to churning out regular in-depth stories that weren't current news but had to be told or were important stories. Those things will probably find ways of happening, a lot of them. I mean, there's never enough time or space to do everything that could be done. What I'm most concerned about, not so much are national stories. I think the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, a number of national organizations will be okay with that. Along with some of my colleagues, I think the real gap is going to be in local coverage. And while these various experiments, you know, let 100 flowers bloom, I mean, try co-ops, try philanthropy, which I think on the margin there might be some successes there. You know, ProPublica might be a model for some, but I don't think that's going to be the overall answer.
Victor Picard.
Yeah, well, I agree with Ben that we should let 100 flowers bloom here and just try to experiment, but we do have to find a way where we are supporting journalists to do those local stories, to do long-form investigative stories. And oftentimes the current market for news production just simply will not support these kinds of journalistic endeavors. So we really do need to find structural alternatives.
Jay Hamilton, I think for you, I have to also ask, is there a market for that?
If you're frustrated by what audience demand is giving you, one way to address it is to lower the cost of discovering or generating the story. So we haven't talked much about transparency and open government, but to the extent that a government makes data more available that allows you to hold it accountable, those stories are more likely to be told.
And final word, Ben Compain.
Well, as I said before, I'm an optimist. With everyone walking around with cameras on their phones or phones on their cameras, whichever, and tweeting, we have lots of eyes out. It's going to be harder, I think, for lots of things to get hidden. I think the important stuff is still going to get out, but it might be in different ways, and this is going to evolve. We haven't seen the whole picture yet.
All right. Well, thank you so much to the three of you. Thank you, Victor Picard, Ben Compain. Thank you, James Hamilton. Really appreciate your time and sharing your thoughts and work with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James T. Hamilton is a professor of public policy, economics, and political science and the director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy. He's the author of All the News That's Fit to Sell, How the Market Transforms Information into News, and Channeling Violence, the Economic Market for Violent Television Programming. Ben Compain is director of the Fellows Program at Columbia University Institute for Teleinformation and lecturer at the DeMore McKim School of Business at Northeastern University. He's the author of The Digital Divide, Who Owns the Media, and The Internet Upheaval. Victor Picard is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is co-editor of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? And was a lead author for Saving the News Toward a National Journalism Strategy. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week. Where the neighbors decide.